Hi, it's Mina Kimes, host of the ESPN Daily podcast. Wake up to the best story you'll hear all day. 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week, where you get an inside look at the most interesting stories at ESPN, as told by the top reporters and insiders on the planet. The breaking news of SportsCenter with the deep dive storytelling of 30 for 30. Today's episode is one I thought you'd especially like. Please listen and subscribe to ESPN Daily wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
How would you, Coach, put into words what is at stake this Saturday?
Everything's on the line. This is going to be a physical war. We're prepared for it. Go Tigers.
That was the one and only LSU head coach, Ed Orgeron. His number two ranked Tigers take on number three ranked Alabama tomorrow in what is shaping up as the game of the year in college football. Alabama's won eight straight in this rivalry. But this isn't the same old LSU offense. And with a Heisman hopeful at QB, could this finally be the Tigers' year? I'm Mina Kimes. It's Friday, November 8th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Indeed.
So I have watched Joe Burrow and that boy good.
He is good, good.
He looks like a bad guy on a CW show, like for teen, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like a bad guy from like Supergirl or from Riverdale. Yeah.
Ryan McGee is a senior writer for ESPN who's surprisingly knowledgeable about teen dramas.
Yeah, this again, I have a 15-year-old daughter. This is my world.
So yeah, I'm impressed. Yeah. I am impressed. Ryan, you've been covering college football for a very long time. How big of a deal is this game?
It's the biggest. And it's not just about the numbers next to the names. I mean, this is 20 years in now of this game determining who wins the SEC West. That's the power division in college football. And it begins and ends with Alabama and LSU. And, you know, the numbers are what they are and the national championship trophies are what they are. And that's why this game will always be a big deal. And, oh, by the way, it doesn't hurt that, you know, there's twos and threes next to their names.
Why is this matchup in particular this year compared to recent years so exciting to watch?
LSU is suddenly multidimensional.
Burrow steps up and will take a downfield shot and has Chase and he'll score.
Position. I was at the Auburn-LSU game 2 weekends ago. It was LSU's last game. And when you walked the tailgates there around Death Valley, the questions weren't, hey, do you think we have a chance against Alabama? It was, do you think we'll be favored at Alabama? And there's a confidence that comes with the fan base, with the team, with everyone involved, because now they know they can score points. Their defense has been so good for so long, and they've had offensive talent. They've just not really done anything with that. And now they're running a 21st century offense. As a result, everybody believes they can win the game as opposed to can we just hang with Alabama?
You mentioned that their defense has been good for a really long time. Some of that stems from back when Nick Saban, who's Alabama's coach now, coached LSU. How did he change the program when he came in years ago?
I, Mina Kimes, hate the phrase changing the culture so much when it comes to college football, but that's what he did. And it's interesting, when I was down there for the Auburn game, so much of the support staff, the equipment guys, the training staff, they were all there when Saban was there. And they all talk about how things changed. It was kind of a poor but proud football program. They had their moments, but they didn't really have their seasons. They certainly didn't have their eras. And Nick Saban created a completely different mindset, which is why can't we compete with the Alabamas and the Auburns, and why can't we play with these guys? And so he changed everything. And the great what if for everyone down there is what would life have been like had he not left for the Dolphins and ended up in Tuscaloosa? Even as successful as they are now, it's like, man, what would it have been like if Nick had stayed?
Well, he was replaced in 2005 by Les Miles.
I think a great debt of gratitude goes to Nick Saban. He is a guy with tremendous vision.
How did the team change after that?
It really didn't. It was more of a, I have this machine. Why in the world would I mess with it? They won their national championship.
Well, congratulations to the LSU Tigers. The 2008 BCS National Champions.
The problem that occurred was that as the years went on, Les Miles stuck to that original machine, no matter how antiquated it became. Les Miles would literally walk into the meetings of his offensive coaches and they would say, "Coach, this is what we got. And we're adding these 30 pages to the playbook. It's going to be awesome." And he would say, "No, you know, we have to announce our presence with authority. We have to play, you know, in the box and, you know, win the line of scrimmage and all this stuff." And they're like, okay, that won a lot of games, that approach. And it continued to win 10 games a year. But that was kind of it.
Maybe the last time a matchup between these two teams was this hyped was back in 2011, right? When LSU was number one, Bama was two. People were calling it the game of the century. You had stars on both sides. This was back when Alabama had A.J. McCarron and Trent Richardson. LSU had Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry.
Yeah, we'll score that game.
9-6.
Place kick in the air. LSU wins. I can tell you for sure now, LSU wins.
That game is so legendary. There are people all around the country who said that game was like, why are we playing a 1941 game?
These are two good defensive teams. Let's say that, okay? Just about what we thought. Holy cow.
Oh, boy.
There was so much talent in that game, so much offensive talent in that game, but that was... it was the heavyweight fight, and it's still old school football fans point to it as this beautiful night of football. And that was the night that Alabama, from that point forward, they kind of changed what they did.
Later that season, the two teams met again in the national championship.
Two college football giants, number one versus number two, LSU and Alabama.
This time, Alabama won 21-0. LSU couldn't even get the ball past the 50-yard line in the first half.
The frustration there, if you're an LSU fan, was you've already beaten this team once in this type of football game, and now they've done a little something extra offensively to pull away, and you can't move the football.
Waiting for the snap. Jefferson has it, runs option to the left into the boundary. It's where, no gain. Three and out for the second drive for LSU.
LSU, that offense was so awful that night. The lack of creativity, not even trying to go downfield.
Jefferson's back to pass on second and 10. He throws again for Beckham to the 43. Wow, throw a party on Bourbon Street. A double-digit gain for LSU and their second first down of the game.
And that was kind of the night of the departure when Alabama went off and did their thing, and LSU just couldn't keep up.
Alabama gets a second chance and makes the most of it. They win the BCS championship.
How did both teams' offenses evolve after that year?
Well, Alabama evolved. LSU did not. And Alabama didn't want to evolve. I mean, the man who installed that mindset in Baton Rouge had also installed it at Alabama to an even greater degree of success and could feel him starting to open the gap a little bit between himself and the rest of college football. When that gap started to close a little, they start losing to Ole Miss with Hugh Freeze's offense. They start losing to Texas A&M with Johnny Manziel. Those were the teams that they had a difficulty beating. Clemson with Deshaun Watson. That's when, reluctantly, Nick Saban changed his entire offense.
Well, we have some breaking sports news for you on this Friday evening. Alabama coach Nick Saban has hired a new offensive coordinator.
He went and hired Lane Kiffin when he was available. Lane Kiffin kind of brought all these other USC guys in with this more imaginative offense, and they started recruiting players like Jalen Hurts, like Tua Tagovailoa. And guess what? They widened the gap again, and they certainly widened it with LSU, who was refusing to do any of this.
Why do you think Les Miles was stuck in his ways? Why didn't he, you know, look across to Alabama, see what was happening there, and decide to evolve his offense too?
Everyone loves Les Miles so much, and he's the eating the grass guy, and he's the still wants to draw defensive schemes up in the dirt guy, all that stuff. But that same mentality that makes him so entertaining and so old school and the Mad Hatter and all that stuff, that also translated into old school offense. Real man football is tractor pull football, and that's what he wanted to do. And unfortunately, that's not what everyone else was doing.
After the break, how LSU finally changed its ways on offense, and is it enough to get them past Nick Saban's defense?
Thank you.
clock ran out on Les Miles and the LSU Tigers against Auburn Saturday night, and man, ain't that the truth. Triple zeros on the Mad Hatter's career as the school fired the coach Sunday afternoon.
So in 2016, Les Miles gets fired. Ed Orgeron takes over. How does he go about changing the LSU offense?
Well, it's interesting because I had known Coach O for a long time, and what he says he learned was what Les Miles never learned. He just started kind of changing everything and was like, let's take the offensive talent we have and see what we can do with it.
We're going to look at recruiting the best offensive coordinator in football.
He hired Steve Ensminger and just said, listen, you're someone with a background in multidimensional offenses, and I'm going to get – again, he made the promise, I'm going to get out of your way, which is something that Les Miles, for all his greatness, just never figured out. And even at the end of Ensminger's first year as offensive coordinator in 2018, he even went to Coach O and said, you know what, we could open this thing up if you really want to. And so what did Ed Orgeron do? He drove down the road to New Orleans, and he hired Joe Brady away from the New Orleans Saints. You know, if you want to kill a couple hours, you ask Drew Brees about Joe Brady. And Brady walked in, and he had an entirely new chapter to that playbook. And from minute one, he and Joe Burrow, who had just transferred in from Ohio State, were on the same page. And the video game numbers commenced.
Pickup of 18. Burrow right back at it. Into the end zone. And Jefferson is there. And Burrow with the quick strike.
Brian, you mentioned how LSU had offensive players like Odell Beckham Jr., Jarvis Landry, you know, who are now in the NFL. What do you think they think when they watch this LSU offense now?
Oh, I know what they think. You know, we asked OBJ about this week, and I talked to several former LSU players who were in the league. I talked to several former LSU players from back in the day, and they all are so excited. And they're rooting for this team so hard, but they're all super jealous, like super, super jealous. These guys are all like, yeah, my friends who are still on the team are texting and saying, man, you'd have so many touchdowns right now. And OBJ's like, yeah, that's great, but that didn't help me out now. And his numbers were still good, but he didn't catch – he had a handful of touchdown catches. A lot of yards. He'd get you into the red zone, but they weren't going to throw it to him in the end zone. Tommy Hodson, really the only like pure passing quarterback that LSU's ever had. And he played at LSU in the late 80s, and his career passing record there never be broken. He was a starter for 4 years. But Joe Burrow's going to get like two-thirds away there in just 2 years. And Hodson was like, get that thick Cajun accent. He's like, McGee, I'd like to play one quarter with that playbook. Just one drive with that playbook. Because those guys always wonder, what could we have done? Because that was always the question. What could LSU do if they just let them do it?
Do you think they would have made these changes if Saban hadn't changed Alabama's offense?
Not a chance, because at the end of the day, it's the only measuring stick they care about. You know, if you go back and look at what LSU has and has not accomplished over the last 10 years, it's all about what Alabama has or has not accomplished. There's a lot of years in there where they've won 11, 12 games, and they got that one loss, the one crucial conference loss, and it's always to Alabama. So, yeah, if Nick Saban doesn't do what he did, then I don't think they change it. I don't think there's a lot of schools that don't change, because they could always point to the guy, you know, the GOAT, and say, well, he hasn't changed. Once he changed, it kind of gave everyone else the excuse to open it up, and that's just what college football is now.
You mentioned that LSU fans are still always asking, what if? What if Nick Saban had stayed?
Right.
Do you feel like Coach O's success has quelled that feeling a bit?
A little bit. And it's because they now have a different identity. When they were still basically the same team that Saban had established, had coached, had put into place, and they're still that same team, the names have changed, and nothing had really evolved. It's very easy to say, what would it have been like if the guy that started all this was still there? But now that you are playing a completely different brand of football offensively, and you have a different identity, and heaven knows if you're in Louisiana – you can certainly relate more to Ed Orgeron, who was literally born almost on the edge of the bayou. That's your guy. That's your identity. And if you've got Coach O and you've got that offense, you don't need Nick Saban. That's how they're starting to feel now. And the next step in this 12-step plan of cutting yourself off to your Nick Saban pinings is, you know, beat him. Once you do that, you're officially over it.
What are the chances we get a grinded out, low scoring slugfest this weekend?
I think the chances are better that we will see more points, but there's certainly no lack of a chance that we'll end up with a slugfest. And I think the reality is that as much as everybody LSU loves this new offense and 50 points a game, and as much as everyone in Alabama loves Tua and 50 points a game, if this game was 9-6, I think there's a lot of people in both fan bases would be like, now this feels right. You know, as much as they love what they have now, there's still a part of them that would love to see it. And I think there's a little piece of Saban that would love to get into one of those so that he would know that his team could win one of those in addition to winning one, you know, 48-41.
Is Tua going to play?
Yes, he is. Don't believe anyone that tells you that he's not. Talking to all the guys that cover the team full time, and they're all like, he's fine. The official line is, game time decision, but I can tell you exactly what that game time decision will be, which was number 13 will be out there. And he might not be 100%, but at 80%, he's still better than most everyone else at 100.
Well, we've pretty much guaranteed it's going to be 9-6.
Yeah. And if that happens, I will thoroughly enjoy walking through the parking lot back to my rental car and all the old guys liquored up going, that's real football, McGee.
Football.
Football.
Is how it's pronounced, yeah.
That's right.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yep.
I'll be back in a moment with one more story. Before I get to my last story, I want to thank everyone who's been listening to our podcast so far. And now that we're a few weeks into it, I'd love to hear from you in the reviews. Let us know how we're doing, what other stories you'd like us to cover, what you ate for breakfast today, seriously, anything. And now, here's a story I want you to know. In 2015, the New York Times Magazine published a big story about a middle distance runner named Mary Kane. When she was 17 years old, Mary became the youngest American woman to ever compete in the World Championships, finishing second in the 1500-meter race. She was working with Nike as part of the company's Oregon Project, an initiative run by a famous coach named Alberto Salazar, and she was widely seen as one of, if not the most, talented high school runners in a generation. Then, Mary Kane stopped competing. The reasons were unknown until now. Yesterday, Mary published a video essay in the New York Times titled, I Was the Fastest Girl in America Until I Joined Nike.
I joined Nike because I wanted to be the best female athlete ever. Instead, I was emotionally and physically abused by a system designed by Alberto and endorsed by Nike.
In the video, she says that under Salazar's tutelage, she experienced extraordinary pressure and humiliation. She was weighed in public and told to take drugs that weren't allowed in the sport. And when she cried out for help, she was ignored. Recently, Salazar, who denies these allegations, was banned from the sport by the U.S. Anti-Doping Association, a ruling he plans to appeal. Nike is shuttering the Oregon Project, and the company's CEO just stepped down. But as Kane points out in her piece, none of this addresses the underlying problem, which is that, like so many young women in sports, she was being trained in a system designed by men for men under the aegis of a company that looked the other way to subsidize a culture that prioritized winning above everything. All of which needs to change. With the help, I hope, of people like Mary Kane. I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Michael Baltierra, Troy Farkas, Alexander Hyacinth, happy birthday, Alex, Michael Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Christopher Tuminello, whose birthday is also this weekend, and Aaron Vale. I'll talk to you Monday.